Welcome, everyone, to another edition of ACE's Patient Focused Update, the podcast for Americans for Safe Access, the nation's leading organization standing for patients' rights to medical cannabis. And joining us is the Chief Science Officer, Dr. Jehan Marku. Jehan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Russ. It's nice to be here.
There's so much going on in the world of medical cannabis, and these days it's kind of intersecting with the pharmaceutical world in that we have this opiate overdose crisis people are talking about. The President's Opioid Commission just came out with their recommendation letter. Governor Chris Christie is the head of that commission, and they firmly rejected the idea that medical cannabis could be some sort of alternative, some sort of help with this crisis. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I know you've got a big push coming up about end pain, not lives, and that kind of ties into this whole opiate and painkiller issue. How wrong is the President's Commission on this particular issue, and what is the science showing us?
That's a great question. So there is a fair amount of research out there about opiates. There is a I think a responsibility by the commission to be more forthright with the data they used and communications they used to come up with their decision. You know, notoriously they cite and a study which looks at the cannabis medical cannabis area before there were dispensaries, before Colorado's laws passed, and saying that they saw an increase in abuse. And so there's a lot of flaws in this study. In fact, the only study we know of that they cited, which came out a few weeks ago. So I think what we're going to do at Americans for Safe Access for our End Pain, Not Lives campaign is actually FOIA the request for how did they make their decision? You know, did they just talk to one person? How many scientists did they talk to? How many researchers did they talk to who actually work with this or work in pain clinics? And I think that they owe it to the public to see that due diligence. But to advocate for Congress to preserve medical cannabis to fight the opioid crisis, Americans for Safe Access kicked off this End Pain, Not Lives campaign on November 1st. And this basically has a couple goals, is to pass, you know, new regulations and legislation to make it easier for people with pain and chronic pain and opioid use disorder to utilize medical cannabis in their treatment plans. To leverage cannabis therapies in combating the opioid crisis by passing things like the Carreras Act and other legislation like the CJS amendment, you know, and also increasing education and research. But our direct action event was a rally on Capitol Hill on November 1st, and we began with a silence for the 91 Americans who died daily from prescription overdose. And we had following that moment of silence, Congressman Earl Blumenauer addressed the crowd, and he, you know, came out very powerfully saying, "The opioid crisis is a national emergency, killing 147 people a day. We must do more to help the families and communities torn apart by addiction. At the very least, the federal government should stay out of the way as states allow access to safer alternatives to opioids, like medical cannabis." And so, you know, ASA is gathered on November 1st, asked Congress to maintain the medical cannabis CJS amendment, which defunds or removes funding for the DEA to go after legal programs. And, you know, this is important because states that have cannabis programs are experiencing a 25% decrease in opioid-related overdoses and deaths. And, you know, with a country where 1 in 3 citizens suffer from chronic pain and 1 in 10 have this type of pain for a day or 3 months or more, including medical cannabis as part of a healthcare approach, is not just a law enforcement response. You know, these cannabis programs are saving lives according to the data that we see. And it's something that people with chronic pain need. They need these options. They also need things like the Rohrabacher-Blumenauer Amendment so that these people who are suffering with chronic pain who want to use medical cannabis, they'll actually have a real option. And so I think we're getting a little bit nervous as December's approaching and wondering if the CJS amendment is going to be approved, because I think that's going to be key to patients and their providers being able to continue to make cannabis an option.
I would encourage listeners to check out safeaccessnow.org to get information on how to contact your representatives to make sure they know how important this amendment is to them.
Absolutely. And if you're not sure where to start, you can always go to safeaccessnow.org to click on some of our tabs to get there. And, you know, this is an important event where we have to come together and work with other groups. And so we also worked on a letter addressed to elected officials with the Michael J. Fox Foundation, U.S. Pain Foundation, Epilepsy Foundation, National Women's Health Network, Realm of Carings, and ASA as well. And, you know, we also had sister events in Ohio, South Carolina, Utah, Illinois, South Carolina, and Idaho, where advocates got together in this National Day of Action. So I think there's lots of room here. You know, these aren't exclusive events. These are events for all of us who are interested in this issue, even if not directly interested in medical cannabis, should be involved with. And, you know, I think we also need more doctors and clinicians to come out in favor, and especially if clinicians and doctors want to continue to be that trusted and reliable source of information for their patients regarding treatment options, they need to educate themselves on this issue, because chances are their patient is already using medical cannabis in some way to treat their symptoms. And they have to be knowledgeable on this topic and be able to discuss the pros and cons with their patients. And I think, you know, there still needs to be some more research done in this area, but you could say that about anything. We don't know everything about anything, but there still is a ton of promising research out there.
Governor Christie, in his letter with that Opioid Commission, the only study or survey I could see that he referenced had to do with something from National Institutes of Drug Abuse claiming that a youth who got involved with marijuana would have a 2.5 times greater chance of developing an opiate dependency, which opens up the question, okay, but what about the people who are adults who already have an opiate dependency? Well, those are the ones we should be thinking of.
Yeah, and that study is, again, deeply flawed. The researchers actually in that study that's pulled from say in the conclusion that you should interpret the results of their report with caution due to the quality, because they didn't distinguish between street marijuana use, they didn't distinguish between medical cannabis use, because there were no medical cannabis, there were no adult use states at the time that they conducted these surveys, which did not confirm that the people actually use the product. You're just telling people that maybe you'll pay them if they tell you how much cannabis they're using. So, you know, surveys are only as good as their methods. And even the authors of this study are telling people to hesitate between drawing correlations from a study that only shows associations that have no clinical relevancies or even can correlate to any clinical effects. The study did not distinguish really between, medical use, non-medical use, even if people were actually using cannabis or just, you know, something that was green leafy vegetable material that they were purchasing off the street. So I think that study is interesting, but will it repeat? And if that study is so true, why are we seeing reductions in similar behavior in programs that have adult use and medical cannabis laws? That takes a baseline and looking at an increase in that during a time when there were very few dispensaries open in the country. So it's a little hard to take it seriously. And in our last Cannabis Science Corner, our Facebook Live event, we tackled some questions about that report as well.
This is, and of course, on the other side, when we look, you had mentioned the studies that are showing 25% lower opioid overdose mortality in the states that have robust medical cannabis programs, defined as a non-oligopoly, you know, situation where people can actually have decent access to cannabis. I came across some research from Acclara Research that showed 67% of the patients they had surveyed were able to reduce, or actually 67% were able to eliminate opioid use altogether, another 29% able to reduce their opioid use. Why is this research not having an effect on the decision-making process going on in Washington, D.C.? I have my ideas. I'm curious what you might think.
Well, I think that's why we have things like the Information Quality Act. There are issues with how data is treated. And, you know, I think there's a lot of politicians, as we've seen with this Opioid Commission, who like to cherry pick data and you know, you criticize them about the data and it rolls right off their back. And so we can hold elected officials and our representatives accountable through, and this is what ASA did with the DEA. And if you go to the DEA's website, you'll notice that one of their hallmark articles is no longer there. So we filed an IQA petition and sued the DEA last year through the Information Quality Act, citing their denial of rescheduling petition, where they actually made some very positive statements about cannabis fulfilling many of the factors for it to be rescheduled or considered for rescheduling. But on their website, they said completely different things about its effects on human health. And so we were able to use publicly available information to put some pressure on them. And there's more of that story going to be coming in the next year. And I think the same thing we can apply to the commission. We can say, well, we have a Freedom of Information Act that we can use. We want to see all details of what happened there. We want, to hold them accountable. We're going to have to use what is available to us if we want to do that, because otherwise I feel that it'll roll right off their back. And so that's what ACE is working towards. And if you're interested in helping us with these efforts, we definitely could use, we'll put you to work if you want to help us with the opioid campaign and holding elected officials accountable, as well as making sure that the right data is being considered. And it's not just one study they're looking at that has never been reproduced with lots of limitations, and that they're actually looking at clinical data and that they're reaching out to people who have clinical experience to actually work in pain clinics. And I think part of the issue may be is that they're only focusing on the addiction side. And if you talk to an addictionologist who's usually paid by the state to take people for court-ordered drug treatment, so instead of serving jail time, you go to a drug treatment program, they see everything as an addiction, even exercise. They see people, they treat. So to them, they fit everything into it's an addiction paradigm, regardless of how addictive it is. You know, giving up drugs for one drug or one drug for exercise or other things that people use like that, you know, so there's a fundamental problem there. And so I think we have to really look to clinicians who actually treat the patients. And I know it's kind of like splitting technical hairs here, but we really have to look to the clinicians who are trying to treat pain, you know, the ones who are working on the front lines to actually develop treatments for patients, develop those clinical studies to compare how effective these treatments are objectively.
There was a statement in the letter, the opioid letter, that really shocked me. And I just want to read this to you because as a clinician, as someone who understands, you know, people working with pain, I think this was shocking. It reads, quote, "The expectation of eliminating a patient's pain as an indication of successful treatment and seeing pain as the fifth vital sign, which has been stated by some medical professionals as unique to the United States, was cited as a core cause of the culture of overprescribing in this country that led to the current health crisis. This must end immediately," end quote. And I read that and I'm thinking, is this the commission saying, tough it up, you're just going to have to live with pain for the rest of your life?
It certainly sounds like something our current administration would say. I'm not really, it's kind of hard to suss out the politics from science in that statement, to be perfectly honest. So it does sound a little cold, to be diplomatic. Think that that's, you know, the sort of pick yourself up by your own bootstraps sort of mentality. But ignoring that, it's there, you know, we have a lot of people who live really long in this country. We have a great, and there's a lot of complications that come with that. You know, if you live long enough, you're either going to get cancer, dementia, or a chronic pain disorder. And usually those two first things I mentioned have a pain component with them. And so, you know, we have at least 40 million Americans living with chronic pain. And I think that with such a large degree of the population trying to look for treatments for that and ways to that minimize adverse events and adverse effects, I think that that might be a dereliction of responsibility potentially in that statement.
Yeah, it just shocked me, and I'm glad to hear your take on that. Dr. Marku, let's talk about some other research. I mentioned the study on medical cannabis and opiate use. You mentioned the 25% reduction in opiate deaths. Is there any other interesting cannabinoid research we ought to know about or update our listeners about?
Well, you know, I have to say 2017 has been a great year for cannabidiol and basic research. In terms of like in petri dishes and animals and methods of analysis and extraction, I think we should buckle up for the rest of the year because there's going to be a lot more intensive scrutiny. And I think for our next podcast, we should talk about some of the product safety studies about CBD because I think that we're going to see more of that in the very near future because people are seeing all this research come out where, you know, CBD can help to extinguish fear memories. And this was in the Journal of Pharmacology last month. We're looking at other, you know, interesting conditions for CBD. There's been a lot of attention at CBD in clinical studies and lots of reviews and meta-analyses of clinical studies to really kind of figure out how to maximize the efficacy of CBD in like studies that deal with anxiety or pain or looking at anti-epileptic drugs and how they differ and how they might improve existing treatment conditions. And people are looking at those products and trying to make decisions. So I think this research is really pushing more focus on the quality of CBD products on the market. But I would say, you know, still the most promising research that exists is the extracts that contain both THC and CBD, and I'm talking about the nabiximols, the most common one that people be familiar with is Sativex, which is a CO2 hash oil extract of a CBD-rich plant material and a THC-rich plant material, which is put in a 1-to-1 ratio and sprayed under the tongue in an ethanolic tincture. And so that product has shown to be more effective than either THC or CBD alone. And I think we have to really start thinking about how are we going to preserve the plant when we talk about CBD, because it's not just about pure CBD. Pure CBD, pure THC, they're not the best ideal drugs. Pure THC, right, Marinol, is not a great drug. Pure CBD, you know, we're seeing in studies people using hundreds of milligrams to get a therapeutic effect, especially in adults per dose. So that could be a lot per day, very expensive. And so definitely looking at it in a whole plant setting, it appears to be more effective when looking at these double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled studies that they have conducted with this product. So we're seeing a lot of research come out just looking at CBD, but we have to remember that when this moves out of the bench and into the clinic, it's the whole plant extracts that are performing better than individual compounds alone. But I would encourage
that entourage effect that we often speak about.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, the other news with regard to cannabidiol, which has blown up in the country since about 2014 in the Sanjay Gupta weed special, people became transfixed by the case of little Charlotte who had the seizures, and the seizures go away with the CBD. And that has led to an explosion of companies and products and information and misinformation out there about CBD, culminating most recently in the FDA sending some letters out to these companies, warning them that they can't claim CBD cures cancer, for example. What do you think about this from our aspect as advocates and activists? Are we helping or harming, or how? What's your take on the whole CBD situation and these FDA letters?
So this is part of the reason why I've devoted a lot of my time at ASA with their program called Patient Focused Certification that looks at the liability of claims made on products. And you know, there are standards for this under DSHEA, the Dietary Health and Supplement Education Act, which allows you to make claims about products outside of the FDA. But first of all, I think this shows us that we have a long way to go to protect medical cannabis. And we also have to remember that the powers of the state, of the government, are awesome, like compared to the average person. I mean, think about just the resources that are available to the federal government to go after an individual company. It can be intimidating, and I think this is just the tip of the iceberg for the FDA. We know also that other agencies like OSHA, Occupational Health and Safety, are visiting facilities and issuing substantial fines for things you'd expect other businesses to have. But I think we have to, you know, we still have to be careful about what we say on social media, how you present yourself, how you use patient testimonials. And to be perfectly honest, you know, I would say, where is that study that shows that CBD cured cancer in humans? And so if the industry is going to make claims, they should do research on their products. And I know that there are some practical issues with getting that done. But at the same time, you have to ask yourself, well, where does this claim come from? Am I extrapolating from a study done in a plastic test tube? Or am I talking about something that's been observed objectively in a controlled trial? You should also ask yourself, what are we doing with these products for safety? How have we tested the safety of these products? Did we just, you know, formulate it and put it on the market the next day? Or did we actually do some safety, some sort of basic safety analysis? And I think that where the industry is going to have to go is starting to actually pay for research, like other companies, coming together to develop research study designs that address the questions that they need to address about the safety, about their products, about claims they can make. And so there are some institutions who are engaging companies in that. But I think by being, I think that this plays right into the hands of one, scaring people about medical cannabis products. And I think this is just the first wave of some of the backlash I think we can expect. And, you know, I think we really have to be on guard and vigilant to protect medical cannabis right now. You know, you can see with the commission, with the FDA putting out these series of letters, you know, they are, you know, this is definitely a vulnerability. There's risks here. And, you know, in the early days of ASA, the risks were first just raids from the federal government. Now we have risks of FDA inspections, OSHA violations, and the list is growing and growing as that Venn diagram grows and connects and overlaps with other regulatory agencies.
Yeah, it's and it's a lot easier to understand, easier to present a protest against raids. You know, people in wheelchairs getting handcuffed by jackbooted thugs makes for really good TV. Trying to explain to the public an OSHA violation and a fine and that's going to be a little harder to deal with.
Well, and I think that's the real trick is putting this in value terms that medical cannabis patients, their clinicians, and their providers can understand. But this isn't going away right away. We have to remember that the FDA sent letters to, I believe, more than 25 products from a variety of companies, but they have to respond to the FDA. These are not just one-off letters. These letters have been made public. It addresses, you know, the company directly and the specific violations. And so these violations are a matter of public record now, and their responses may also be part of that public record as well. And I think it's a good idea to be a little bit more critical. And if you don't have a compliance officer at your cannabis company, if you're not reaching out to experts who've been doing this for 10 or 15 years, it's a really good idea to always have your labels, your products, your compliance reviewed by an objective third party. And I think that is one of the tools that's available to some of these companies.
Well, we will have to dig more into the whole cannabidiol issue on a future episode. I know it's something we could spend a whole episode on. Dr. Jehan Marku, Chief Science Officer for Americans for Safe Access. You can find the website at safeaccessnow.org. Make sure you take a look at their patient-focused certification and their educational opportunities for both patients and clinicians. And thanks so much, Jehan, for joining us again here for the ACES Patient-Focused Update.
Thank you. Better living through phytochemistry.